realize that some of you are here because you know very little about chemical dependency. Some of you are here because maybe you've had personal experience in your lives. And so you're coming from different perspectives. And before role-playing the intervention and talking about prevention, I think it'd be very helpful to give you a little bit of information about chemical dependency as a disease. And also, if an intervention is to take place, generally the counselor will work with the people that are going to do the intervention and would present material similar to what I'll present to you in about a 5 minute or 10 minute sketch. We have 8 people that are going to role play an intervention. We have the alcoholic's spouse, a neighbor, the pastor, 2 children, a supervisor, and a co-worker. I think I got everybody.
Son-in-law.
And a son-in-law, right? Now, one of these 8 people came to see a counselor concerned about Pat's drinking. And what would happen then is that you just sort of leave the alcoholic out, leave him be for a little bit, and you work with these 8 people, helping them to see that chemical dependency is a disease, that it's a primary disease, that it's progressive, that it's chronic, and it is fatal. An alcoholic has a lot of problems, social problems, problems at work, problems with the spouse, maybe physical problems, maybe spiritual problems. You can't work on any of these other problems if drinking is involved. You have to first get at the primary problem, which is the fact that he's an alcoholic or that he's abusing a certain chemical. It's progressive in that if you don't get help for the alcoholic, the disease is going to get worse and worse. It's chronic in that you can't cure it. You can arrest it, but you can't ever cure it. If an alcoholic goes back to drinking, eventually it's fatal and he'll die. Alcoholism is 100% fatal unless you can get help, medical help, for the alcoholic. Okay, these 8 people then have gathered and they've come in to the office, and I'm going to explain to them a couple basic points. One is that chemical dependency is a sick, unhealthy relationship with a mood-altering chemical. All of us have relationships. We have relationships with people, we have relationships with things, we have relationships with certain chemicals. We're a society that uses chemicals. If we can't go to sleep, what do we take? Sleeping pill. If we've had a hard day at the office, what might we do on the way home? Okay, stop for happy hour, social hour, that's even what we call it, happy hour. Normal, healthy people have a lot of meaningful, significant relationships with other people. Their universe is very big, and these are very important. They also have relationship with things, with job, with vacation time, with hobbies, with certain activities, with certain possessions, and they have relationships with certain chemicals. And some chemicals you use legitimately. If you're sick and you're prescribed tablets to take 1 every 4 hours and you do that, that's legitimate use of a mood-altering chemical. When we celebrate communion, we have wine, that's legitimate use of a mood-altering chemical, just a little bit so it doesn't alter the mood too much. What happens with a person that is an alcoholic or chemically dependent is that the relationship map, people to people, shrink up. Likewise with things. And the most significant relationship becomes the love relationship with that chemical. A basic trust is developed with MAC, with the mood-altering chemical, and it's more important than the relationship the person has with other people, a spouse or family, more important than the job or certain activities or certain hobbies. And that's very basic. It's sort of the starting point in working with loved ones who have gathered to make them understand that the root of chemical dependency is in relationships. And what's happened with Pat, person will be role-playing the alcoholic, is that he's developed a significant relationship with the mood-altering chemical that is more important than his relationship with his spouse, with his kids, with his neighbor, with his pastor, with anybody. Okay, that's the basic premise that we're starting from. The other thing, and we take maybe 2 hours to explain that. That'd be the first session. And then the folks would go home. A week later, they'd come back again, and here's what they'd be told. The progression of how Pat became an alcoholic. And to explain this, we use something we call the feeling chart or mood swings. We've all been created, I believe, with an instinct to get high, to feel elevated, to feel good. And most of us function in terms of feelings in the normal range. We don't often experience a lot of extreme joy or euphoria. And we don't every day live in a lot of pain, feeling real low. We function within a fairly normal range of feelings each day. But we learn that there are certain things we can do to swing our mood, to feel better. And you can do this in natural, normal ways. Coming up to Holden, sitting in the jacuzzi and looking at the mountains makes you feel better than normal, right? Some people went up to Cloudy Pass and they said they slid down the snow and they were just feeling giddy. They felt really high. They weren't feeling normal. They were over here. Okay, so in stage one, you learn the mood swing. You learn that certain things can help you feel better, and you can kind of move to the right towards joy, feeling high, and so on. In the case of chemicals, this is what people discover, that if you take certain pills or if you take a drink of something, it's going to make you feel better, a little lightheaded, a little giddy, a little high. Okay? After a period of time, the effect wears off and you return to normal. And so you've learned that this chemical will make me feel better, quote, high. The second stage is that you start seeking the mood swing. And I would bet that all of us in here have learned the mood swing, and all of us in here, on occasion, have sought a mood swing. Certainly in a natural way, but maybe even with a chemical. Picture this, you're going to a party, you know that liquor will be served, and sometimes you kind of look forward to just relaxing and enjoying some wine and being with friends. And, you know, you start seeking occasions when you can feel better, when you can get high. Now, same thing happens. If you move out to the right, with kids, sometimes they experiment mixing marijuana and beer, or you might mix, if two drinks make me feel this good, what will six drinks make me feel? So you start experimenting. And what's happening is that you're starting to establish that love relationship with Mac. When you're feeling normal or kind of down, what can make me feel better? Mac, mood-altering chemical. And so you start seeking it, and normally you'll come back into this area, but once in a while you experience some pain. When you first start out, it might be physical pain, like nausea, or you throw up, or the hangover the day after, but it was worth it. I had such a good time last night at the party, it was worth it, right? And so you kind of pop back over to normal. Now, a lot of people, when they get into trouble, every day at the end of work, they start seeking the mood swing. And so they'll go into the bar and have a cocktail before driving home at night. Or kids, you know, at the end of school every day, they want to get in the car, cruise around, and smoke a few joints. And so they start seeking occasions to be with Mac, because Mac makes them feel good. It helps them relax, gives them pleasure. They can put some of the cares and problems and pains aside. If this goes on long enough, you then move into stage three, which is dependency. In dependency, you may start out here, but quite often now, as you become dependent, you're experiencing more pain in your life, more emotional pain. some problems are occurring. You're fighting with your wife. There's arguments maybe at work. People are noticing that you're changing, and some of your behaviors are getting you in trouble. And so you're experiencing more pain, and you have to use more and more to feel normal or to feel high, and you come back and you keep slipping farther and farther and farther into the pain area. An alcoholic is in a lot of pain. But the relationship with Mac is so important that he builds a wall of defenses around himself. And anybody who wants to interfere with that relationship with the mood-altering chemical is shut out. And he starts rationalizing, projecting. He becomes, sometimes he has blackouts. A lot of things happen to lock him up so that he can't see reality. He can't get out of his own prison, in a sense. And likewise, it's very hard for people to get into his prison. He literally does not know that he's doing all these things he's doing because he's justifying. And he doesn't want anybody to tell him that he's an alcoholic because he doesn't want that relationship to be interfered with. Okay, do you see what's happened? Do you see the progression? Not? Okay, good. another way... well, if dependency goes on long enough, you get into the chronic stage. And if you don't intervene quite soon, when someone's down here, they'll die. Now, the question is, I guess, when do you intervene? Learning the mood swing? Probably not. We've all, you know, that's part of growing up, part of experimenting. We've all learned the mood swing. When someone starts seeking the mood swing, and as you use, another way to look at it is motivation. When you first start, the motivation here is to get pleasure. The motivation here is to seek relief. The motivation here is maintenance. And the motivation here is to escape into oblivion. You just want to get away from everything. Okay? So these are the motivations. Now, you know, there's nothing wrong with seeking pleasure. There's nothing wrong with once in a while seeking relief. But if you need chemicals to maintain a normal existence, what you think is normal, then I think it's time to intervene. And the progression is sort of like this. You start here, and then you go down into seeking. Once in a while, you come back up here. Okay, you see the progression? It's getting worse, isn't it? Once in a while, you might improve. Now, when do you intervene? Here, here, here. Because you see, we're going down into the valley. And what we typically do is we wait till someone's stumbling around drunk, or is in a car accident, or has gotten fired from 3 jobs, or has already had a divorce and is living, you know, a really bad existence, until we do something about it, right? This is quite often what we do. The reason is it's so hard to get through to this person because he shuts you out, and it's very painful. And in fact, people that are close to him and that love him get, in a sense, sucked right into this same free-floating mass of illness. And codependents and family members become almost as sick as the dependent person himself. So this would be explained to the loved ones and let them see that this is where their friend is, and that what we have to do is what? What do you think we're going to try to do at the intervention? We have to break through this wall. We have to break through and confront him with reality. This is what you're doing. Because he doesn't know what he's doing. And so we have gathered 8 people, and we rehearse. I have them write down. I want you to write down specific behaviors that Pat has done that has caused problems or pain or hurt. And next week, I'm going to have Pat come to our session, and I'd like you to go around and read your list to him. And maybe the weight of all eight of you saying that to Pat, it might break into his reality, and he might decide he wants some help. Okay? Now, the people that are going to do the intervention have to be meaningful. A boss, a spouse, a pastor, a neighbor, people that are important to the alcoholic. Otherwise, it won't work. The data that they're going to confront the person with has to be concrete, no value judgments. This is what happened. So he can't weasel out of it. You did this. Okay? Well, let's do the intervention, and then if you have questions, we can talk about that. And then we'll go on and talk a little bit about prevention. You see, the intervention often occurs down in the valley. And we all hop in our ambulances and we go rescue Pat, the alcoholic, and we pick up the pieces, we send him to treatment, and then we help him up the road of recovery. Why can't we build the bridge up here, or the fence, or in here, or in here? We don't have to wait till someone's nearly dead to intervene, although that's typically what we do. The earlier we intervene, the less the defenses have been formed, and so it's easier to get into reality with the alcoholic. The problem is that quite often he hasn't had enough crises yet. There hasn't been enough pain, and we always want to give him the benefit of the doubt, and he always says, I can handle it. Don't bother me, I'm not an alcoholic, and we want to believe him. And so we keep putting it off, putting it off, putting it off. Meanwhile, he's going farther and farther and farther down the slope. Okay, the people that were going to do the intervention, why don't we come in here, and I'll function as the counselor. The family and concerned people would be in a room, and the client and I would come in. Have a seat.
Thank you.
I know all these people here, Pat, and they're here because they have something they want to say to you. And I know you want to respond to each one of them. I'm only going to ask that you wait until everybody has had a chance to speak before you respond. Okay? You agree to that?
Yeah.
Okay. Should we begin?
I'm the neighbor, Pat. We're neighbors on the bowling team together. I know you pretty good. You've changed. Lots of times I've seen you sneak out at night and come home at 2 o'clock in the morning. You put on weight. You don't stop by and visit like you used to. I'm concerned.
Pat, you've worked with me now for, I guess it's been 5 years, and you've been a good employee. But I have noticed that during the past year that you've missed work 13 different times on Mondays, calling in sick. When you first started working for me, you never missed any time at work, and you took pride in your excellent work attendance. Last Monday, you didn't show up for work and there was no call.
Dad, remember last month when you promised to take me to the ball game? Well, you said we'd go at 12 o'clock and you didn't come back until 3. When I'd ask you where you'd been, you pushed me away. I love you, Daddy.
Dad, last week I think it was. Yes, on Friday. You came in my room, kicked at my stereo, and yelled at me to turn it off. Later, you came back and swore at me for no reason at all. Then, on Saturday, when I asked you about it, you couldn't remember.
I'm the pastor. Pat, we've known each other for many years. You were on the search committee that brought me to this town, and your leadership on the church council was a real help. Well, now you seldom come to church, and the last time you did come, you fell asleep.
Pat, I'm the co-worker. Pat, when I came here 2 years ago, you really helped me out, taught me a lot of things. We used to eat lunch together every day. Now you like to go off by yourself. Sometimes, like 2 days ago, you make mistakes in the afternoon, and I have to cover for you.
I'm your son-in-law, Pat. Last weekend, we went fishing. I noticed how you seemed more interested in drinking than fishing. And when we did get on the water, your hand was shaking so badly you could hardly bait the hook. Later, when we returned to shore, you ran the boat up on shore and damaged the motor.
I'm your wife, Pat, and this is hard for me, but I love you so much, I just can't go on like this anymore. I'm embarrassed saying this, but a few weeks ago, you hit me when I told you to stop drinking. You apologized, but that frightened me. Also at the Smith's party, you poured your drink into the ashtray and we were asked to leave.
Well, Pat, do you want to respond to what you've heard these people that are obviously very concerned about you say?
Well, I'm sorry, kids, that I did what you say I did.
Well, you did it. Well, they say that you did it.
Can we wait till tomorrow?
Wait for what?
Well, we'll talk about it tomorrow.
No, tonight's the night we're going to talk about it. This is why we're all here. Because they've told me that you've talked about this a lot of times and you've apologized in the past and said you're sorry, but you keep on drinking. The issue here, Pat, is you're drinking. And we all feel you need help now. Okay, well, we'll stop here. They don't all end up like that easily. He agreed, so what we would do is have... the wife would have brought a suitcase. You want to have a number of options open at this point. Outpatient treatment, inpatient treatment. If he absolutely refuses to agree to anything and you don't want to physically drag him into a treatment facility, you can say, okay, we'll give you one more chance, but in 2 weeks we're going to gather again. Or 3 weeks or 4 weeks, whatever you want to say. And if he is down here, he can't live up to, you know, his promises. And next time we got him. Okay, next time we won't let him get out of it, but we'll let it kind of sit for a while. Okay, in a form, it's kind of open for questions. At this point, let's open it up for observations.
I was impressed by the amount of things that were said, which I mean, they were obviously related to his drinking, but his drinking wasn't mentioned. And is this generally very valuable?
Yeah. In an intervention, you don't want to be you want to be non-judgmental, and you just want to give specific behaviors. These are things that you've done. Yeah, and it's implied, I guess, that it's because you've been drinking that you're doing these things.
In other words, you mean the neighbor wouldn't necessarily know how much they've been drinking, and just observe the change, or the employer doesn't drop on Mondays.
Yeah, there's no way someone can go down here without changing his lifestyle. I mean, things are happening. And all you have to do is keep track of it. Specific, concrete things that you see happening in this guy's life, and then confront him with it. Now, his wife has confronted him, the children have. But the power of an intervention is you got 8 people and you got him in a little room. And it's the weight of everybody saying what they're saying that might break into his little wall of defenses where he might say, what do you want me to do? Or, okay, let's go.
Another thing you mentioned to us earlier was the absence of any over-emotionally charged statements or actions on the part of these people that are in this intervention.
Yeah.
Deliberately kept.
Yeah.
My statement, I should have said he lost weight. Yeah. Gained weight, but I made a mistake.
You rehearse this. Now, in a way, it's contrived, it's manipulative, but it has to be. The best way to get help for that fellow is if there's been some crisis, if he's been involved in a car accident, if something's happened that has been kind of catastrophic, that's the time to go in. And maybe I've been working with these eight people for 2 months and we've just been waiting for the right time. And then we'll move in and give him help. It's important that you don't try to do an intervention just by yourself, because this guy is a master at feelings, because he's way down here and he's way down here. In a sense, he's almost schizophrenic. I mean, you're playing with a guy that can be in extreme pain one moment and up there euphoric the next moment, and you never know where he's at. And he has a tremendous repertoire of defenses to brush aside anything you say. And so you by yourself probably won't be able to pull it off unless you're a recovering alcoholic yourself and cut through all the crap he's given you. But if you're with a counselor or a pastor or someone's trained and you just have specific concrete things, it's the weight of these eight people. Or if you got 20 people.
Or if you only got three.
Or if you got three. If the three people are a boss, a spouse, and someone that's really important, you can pull it off. They have to be important people. If the boss says, look, buddy, you get help or you're fired, and he really loves that job, he might get help, you know.
Might it not be difficult to make the alcoholic understand that he should come to a group meeting like this?
Well, he doesn't necessarily know where he's going.
Surprise party.
Surprise party.
Yeah. But he needs to be your client.
Well, actually, yeah, I said that, didn't I? But the spouse of one of these eight would have been my client, and we've been working together for the past month, and I have the wife drive him over. Or we may do this in his home. We set up a place.
You mean he may not be a client at all?
No, he probably isn't.
Or he is.
Somebody from the family.
Yeah. Someone from the family is who has come to me expressing concern. And I'm not going to even bother with him until I have these people understanding the disease and knowing what they have to do. Because only if we're all working together can we pull it off. Now, the reason we practice it is if in the middle of the intervention one of the kids breaks down and cries and runs over and sits on his lap and says, oh, Daddy, these people are picking on you, or if the spouse gets cold feet and doesn't want to say anything, you know, then it flops. And that's why you actually role play. You go through it, and you have a chair, and you pretend that Pat's sitting there, and you read off, you literally read off your list. And that night, you bring out your list and read it off so that you can't add any little barbs that you often do.
But you mean that you may not have even talked with the alcoholic before?
Right.
What would the alcoholic just get up and say, I'm not having any part of this, and just leave?
That's happened.
Yeah, I would think so.
But quite often they're so overwhelmed they'll at least sit down, and if you get started talking, and you know, they react in different ways. Some will hear it out, and some is a very moving experience, because you got eight people that obviously love and care, you know, and what they say, what one person says might do it, you know. It's a challenge. I've done maybe 12, 15 interventions, and each one's a challenge. You never know how it's going to work out. I've had kids, most of mine have been with kids, you know, some take off crying, running out. I have to go chase them down the halls. But every one we've gotten the person to treatment. They may not agree to go right then, be nice if they would, but, you know, something powerful is happening in that room. And most of them will sit it out to see what it is.
How widely used is this method of intervention?
It's the classic type of intervention that is taught to anybody in the field.
I see. And the success rate is quite high?
Yeah.
Ben?
What are you talking about in terms of percentages in adults who will respond to one such a session? In any kind of treatment, there's always the percentage help, the percentage that you're not helping, the percentage who get worse.
In a percentage of adults that will go to treatment after an intervention like this?
Correct.
Is that your question?
Batting average.
Yeah. Well, let me just say 70%, you know, it's just a ballpark figure. If it's done well and the people, again, have specific information and they're important enough to this person, you can pull it off. I think one person can pull it off if it's the right person saying the right thing at the right time. But you got to be pretty lucky. The chances of getting that person help and not waiting and letting him die are improved if you got 8 people all with a common goal, which is to break into that wall of defenses that the alcoholic has built around him, because he does not know what effect he's having on people anymore. He doesn't care. The only thing that's important is Mac.
Is his state as far as withdrawal or having the alcohol at a good level, any of bear a relationship to his willingness to seek help after this session? In other words, do you get him, is he dried out or is he...
What happens in treatment?
No. You probably don't know what state you'll have him in if the appointment has been for the 8 other people.
Yeah.
So he could come in high.
Yeah.
Or
hopefully he's sober.
Or sober.
Yeah.
Or early in DP.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the spouse knows his drinking patterns well enough so that we can hit a time when he's probably not going to be drunk.
Once he's agreed to go to treatment, does the family go to treatment with him?
Most treatment facilities have a family week now. If he went, we would have a suitcase packed. Let's say we went out the door and we went right to the hospital or treatment facility. He may be put in a wing where it's kind of like drying out. There'd be medical attention and he'd be assessed and evaluated. That may take up to a week. And then he would enter the treatment phase. The first week is evaluation. And then treatment lasts approximately 6 weeks. And he'll be put in a group. They'll work on AA philosophy. The first step in AA is that I admit that I'm powerless and I need help from a higher power. And then you work from there.
The reason that I ask that is that it seems to me I've heard a number of stories about people who have lived quite a long time with an alcoholic in the family. And then finally, when that person comes to a stage of that seeking treatment, it's at that point that when he's in treatment, that's the point at which the family breaks up or the marriage falls apart. And is that that may be because the whole family is not a part of the treatment process?
Well, I suppose that's one reason the family does become involved. There is a family week. What's happened is that the spouse or the family have become sick right along with the alcoholic, and often the whole family hasn't been dealing with reality. And what happens in treatment is that reality is once again reintroduced into this man's life and into the life of the family. And they may be dealing with some real powerful issues and feelings that can tear a marriage apart or can also strengthen it and bring it back together. But if you don't do this, it's going to die a slow death, no question about it.
You said your work was
mostly with young people. Who would you gather in? And evidently they wouldn't have children, bosses, and coworkers. Who would your group be for them?
Well, parents, other teachers. Once in a while you can get a fellow student. Would be the main people.
Brothers or sisters?
Yep.
And this is all through AA, then? Alcoholics Anonymous?
That's the treatment philosophy in most...
Like, how would somebody contact a person of your profession?
Well, mine was all through the school system. That's where I was working. But most communities have an AA chapter, and a medical doctor can refer, or their treatment facilities in most, you know, larger communities. Concerts, yes.
How well does it work for other chemicals as well as alcohol? This method?
Yeah, same. Because the relationship and the seeking after the high feelings are exactly the same, whether it's heroin, pot, alcohol, pills, Valium, doesn't matter. It's a relationship that is being developed with the chemical, no matter what it is, that you have to destroy. Because it's a sick, unhealthy relationship. You have to destroy that relationship.
Doesn't one of the crucial parts be is getting those significant other people in the person's life to make the connection with changes in the behavior with the drug, particularly if they're still in the maintenance or dependency stage, you know what I mean, that they're not so non-functional that it's blatantly obvious. But it seems like that could be tricky or problematic at times for the counselor.
Certainly in stages 2 and early 3, and that's why often we wait until late 3, early 4 before you do anything.
Mm.
Because then it becomes so obvious, you have lots of data.
Mm-hmm.
When you try to intervene a little farther up the hill, it's kind of sketchy. It's easier to get into his defenses, but your facts aren't as concrete.
Mm-hmm. And you might get some people that say, well, they don't think that's deal is, no. Where others would...
Yeah, drinking, using pills, you know, most of the 30 million people hooked on Valium in this country, and most of, you know, the doctors prescribed it.
Mm-hmm.
There are billions of dollars, I showed this in one of the sessions, billions of dollars spent on convincing us to use. And these are, I just passed them around, these are ads for alcohol, cigarettes, any magazine you open up, and there's a tremendous ad campaign going on in this country to get us all to establish a relationship with a certain cigarette. If you're a woman, it should be Virginia Slims, because you've come a long way, baby, and you deserve Virginia Slims. Or gin and tonic after a hard day at the office. Or light beer, if you really like the flavor but you don't want to put on pounds. You know, these people are trying to convince us to use their products. They spend billions of dollars every year convincing us that this is going to make us feel better. And the reason so many of us use is because it works. The reason people get hooked on drugs is because they work. They do make you feel better. They work every time. They don't disappoint you like people do. They don't argue with you. They don't get on your back. They're always there. And so, and they're quick. We talked the other day about the dependency or the high you get from jogging. Well, it takes many long hours and many weeks of running before you start getting that euphoric high that joggers talk about. You can do it, in a couple shots of your favorite drink. You get the same feeling, and it's quick.
In the middle of an intervention session, how do you counter the client's objections to treatment, such as, oh, he's self-employable, I can't be apart from the business. Or he might honestly say, well, you know, we can't afford that kind of treatment. Or he might say, I'll be so embarrassed to my friends here about this, or I sure don't want my wife telling where I am.
Yeah.
How do you counter these
We've rehearsed all that before, and we've checked insurance, mm-hmm. we've checked the treatment facility, so when he brings that up, and he will, we can say no, our insurance coverage will take care of that. If the boss is here, like in this case, the boss says you can get off without any problem. A lot of companies now have employee assistance programs. Mm-hmm. So you try to anticipate the four or five arguments he's going to use, and then you shoot him down so that he's left there with not any of his typical excuses.
You say that it's not supposed to be judgmental. Yeah. They are, the significant others are not supposed to be judgmental in their comments. I'm wondering what it is. Does he feel painted into a corner? Does he read these significant others' comments as caring?
No, he may think that they're picking on him again, and he may react very angrily and in a hostile fashion. But yeah, he may pick something up. Maybe when his son says, "Daddy, I love you," that might, you know, it might do something. It's hard to gauge how he's going to react. Some of them do feel backed into a corner. That's okay, you know, if they'll, even if they come fighting out, you know, if they'll agree to work on it, that's what we're after.
What happens with someone who has a serious drinking problem and won't admit it and says, "Well, every February I quit drinking. I've done this for 10 years every February, so I don't have a problem."
When does he start up again? In March?
Yeah. So how do you deal with that?
Well, does he have a problem? Sure. What are the specific things that let you know he has a problem? Start writing them down. When you get your 30 and five other people have their 30, have an intervention.
How about the people that say, "Well, it was a doctor prescription"? Are doctors now, like, becoming more interested in methods of intervention and such, that they're not prescribing?
Yeah. Well, all these chemicals that we can get hooked on are not the problem. The problem is the person. The chemicals, the drug, is there for our benefit, our enjoyment, our pleasure. The problem is not the drug. The problem is the person and the relationship the person has with the drug. And so the pills that the doctor prescribed were legitimate. They had a beneficial purpose. What happened is the person became dependent on it and started abusing it and developed a strong relationship with the drug, and that's become the problem. So I'm not knocking the doctors for prescribing Valium. It's the person that abused the drug or the beer. You know, I like beer with pizza. I like wine with a nice meal. If I feel I have to have pizza every night so I can have my beer, you know, then I may be abusing it. It's not the chemical, it's the problem. It's the person and the relationship and the desire to get high, which is normal and natural. The drug question is a matter of method. Is using the chemical the best way to get high? The drug problem is a question of method. And a lot of people feel they can't get high, can't feel good, stimulated, elevated in normal, natural ways. They can't feel that way through relationships, through activities, and so they turn to drugs. Okay. And drugs work.
Okay, then, well, I suppose from what you're saying, it's rather obvious that part of the treatment is to show this person. It sounds like some people could be just locked in a never-ending cycle.
Sure.
If they can't, I mean, how does that come about?
So teach people how to get high naturally in
yeah.
some ways, and that happens in treatment. When someone goes to treatment, the whole person is treated. His physical self, his social self, because relationships have fallen flat on their face. His emotional self, because he's out of touch with his feelings. His physical self, they get into meditation or prayer or yoga or jogging or some type of physical. Mental, often they, you know, brain cells are being destroyed every time you have a drink. and you know, just sluggish. Their brain is kind of cluttered up. That's kind of cleared up. So all these dimensions of what a person is, his spiritual self, social, emotional, mental, and physical, is all addressed in treatment. And you're trying to remake the total person and give him ways to find meaning in his life without that sick relationship that he's become so dependent on to feel good.
Isn't the key part of the treatment, isn't the key part of the treatment that the alcoholic himself wants to be cured, wants to be helped? And that's what the intervention is.
The first step, the key, is for the alcoholic to admit that he's powerless. He's messed up. And that he needs help from God. That's the first step. And they don't do anything else until he admits that. And then he may sit in there 8 weeks, stubborn as hell, not saying, you know, I can handle this thing. And they won't do anything more with him until he'll admit that he's powerless and messed up in sin, if you will, and needs God's grace in Christian terms. Now AA they talk about higher power rather than God, but that's what they're talking about.
Have you had a problem like halfway through the treatment where not so much the alcoholic, but the people involved in the treatment fall apart, where they start feeling sorry for that person?
The people that are working with them, or the people that did the intervention here?
The people who did the intervention.
Generally not. No, they're so happy that he's finally getting help, and they're seeing changes, and he's becoming the father and the husband and the worker that they used to know and who they want to see again. So no, that generally doesn't happen.
You say that the problem is the abuse of the drug.
Yes.
Would you say that if someone, all legal aspects aside, that if a person prefers, say, cocaine to a glass of beer occasionally, that will have no harmful effect on you?
Different drugs have a greater or lesser effect. Sugar is a mood-altering chemical. I suppose if you take enough of it over a period of time, you know, it will kill you. LSD has another effect. You can put them on a continuum in terms of the effect, from a very high effect to very low. They kind of slice across here. You have the hallucinogens, LSD, and through here you might have alcohol, nicotine, and caffeine down here. Okay, depending upon your drug of preference. And what a lot of people do, you know, marijuana won't make you move to harder drugs, except you're curious to see what type of highs you can experience. If you start running with people that are into drugs, these others become available. It's just a matter of curiosity and wanting to experience a higher high that turns you onto these other things. Now, I guess how I respond to that is that some drugs are more powerful and more dangerous than others. And so I'm not saying that you know, cocaine is okay if you just use it once in a while. Am I answering you? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying?
But if that's a high, how about cocaine freebase, which is even better?
Sure. And that's what Richard Pryor thought.
Yeah.
But I suspect he's not going to try it again. And some of his friends aren't going to try it again. Yeah.
Well, we can make the point that a lot of people are treated with cocaine medically, for nasal conditions, things like this, occasionally, and don't appear to suffer any ill consequences of it.
That's a much different dose.
So if the reason you're using
Considerably.
Yeah. Well, let me add two other continuums that I found helpful. One is your mindset, and the other is your setting. And a third or fourth is your stress level. Now, I can go out, and if my mindset is that I want to have some beer while I'm watching a ball game to relax, and the setting is in my home, which is very safe, my mindset is to relax, the effect of those six beers might only get me up to about here. Now, if my mindset is that I want to act a little crazy and I'm going to a wild party, I can have those same six beers and the effect on me is about up here. Okay? Same person, same amount of alcohol, but my mindset and the setting and even my stress level determine what it's going to do to me. And for a lot of kids, you know, it's their mindset and it's the setting of cruising around that has the effect. It makes it fun, you know, plus the rebellion, and it's part of growing up and experimenting, and you know, that all enters into why people use.
What effect does the stress have on that?
Well,
I mean, for example, in the first setting, let's say that there was no stress. It's just your mindset is to relax with the beer, and it's not at that moment there's no particular stress.
Yeah, it wouldn't have as much effect on you if you aren't.
You're saying that if you were in stress, though, I mean, if you're sitting there,
it's going to have.
I need to relax today because it's been such an awful week, and
yeah.
I just, you know, God, I should get this stuff done, but I, you know, and then there was stress in it. You say that would have more effect then.
Yeah. It's going to work. Be more powerful.
It would certainly be more powerful for setting up a relationship. I can see that.
That's why Fred and I can go to the same party and we can drink exactly the same, and he'll be stumbling around drunk, and I can walk a straight and steady line. Or I can go to the same party the next night and drink the same as I did the night before, but if my mindset is different, and they have loud music, and the other night they had soft music, I can be stumbling around drunk. You understand how it can affect different people differently, and the same person differently, depending upon what he's thinking and where he's at? Okay.
Then you just answered Nancy's question saying that the family will be really happy that this person's getting treatment. And
hopefully.
Yeah, well, I'm just a little cautious that maybe you're painting too rosy of a picture. I'll speak as a person that's gone through treatment, and it's a lot of hard work, and the family goes through a lot of pain, and everyone has to change. The chemically dependent person goes through a lot of changes, and a lot of relationships change. And when treatment ends, you might not know that person that you did when they went into treatment. The relationships that the chemically dependent person has with each of these eight people is going to change drastically. And the things that the chemically dependent person finds out, and so does each of his family members find out, are gonna cause pain, are gonna eventually turn into good.
Yeah.
But there's gonna be a lot of tension there. And the intervention itself is going to be very difficult, but that's only the first step in a really difficult process. So don't get the idea that it's all going to be real easy and you're all going to be so happy because that person's going to the hospital and now the good fairy is taking over.
That's right.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, thank you for
it's a lot of changes, and it's not all that easy.
They also say treatment is 10% of recovery. The 90% is once you get out and are dealing with these people. Yeah. Good point. Okay, you and you.
The first step is getting the committee together, you said.
Yeah.
What can an outsider do, say a pastor or a neighbor who knows of a family where the alcoholic is existing in that family and the family is existing around the alcoholic? but they're not doing anything to change it. Is there anything an outsider can do to start the ball going?
That's a tough one. Would any of you like to respond to that before I take a crack at it? The question is that if you're a pastor or an outsider and you see someone that's drinking, but the spouse and the children are already part of the disease and they're enabling or they're alibiing and they don't want to admit that someone in their family is becoming an alcoholic. Is that stating it? What can you do?
Well, couldn't you have an intervention for the person who's close to the alcoholic?
They have organizations such as Teen and On, you know, for the teenagers that are affected by.
I guess the way I'd answer that is you have to wait for a crisis to occur.
There's not much you can do until that.
Yeah, you have to wait till some pain comes in there and then you can step in. I know that's not a very neat answer, but
probably reality.
That's reality, and yeah. The best way to break into reality is to have a grouping of crisis very close together, because that'll do wonders to get in there. So sometimes you just have to wait.
Asking questions or bringing up the alcoholism, say to the spouse, tend more to alienate that person from you, do you think?
They may, they may use that as an excuse to drink more. On the other hand, it may show that you're concerned and caring, and one night when they are drunk, they may pick up the phone and call you because they remember you expressed concern. There's no easy pat way to answer that one. Look, you know, if we had this down to a science, we wouldn't have the problems. You know, it is an art, and it's a difficult challenge, and we don't know all the answers, and that's why we have 10 million alcoholics walking around out there, getting ready to die. Well, it's 10 o'clock. We'll keep going, but people can feel free to leave if they want.
Can you take just one quick short question? And it's off the subject. If you don't think you want to address it, all right. But I'm just wondering, in light of your experience with counseling and so forth, intervention and all, what might be your suggestion as to the best method of prevention?
Right.
For caring people to intervene before intervention is needed.
Right. Yeah, that was the other half of the session tonight. We had 2 minutes on that.
Right here.
Well, they're right here.
Yeah.
So we do have to. Let's do this. There's a session tomorrow at 4, which was a Christian response to dependencies. And I was going to talk about dependent or free and bring in some. More a Christian perspective, but let me address prevention and promotion of health at the session tomorrow at 4 for those of you that want to explore this further.